My name is Kenan Marcelli. This is an interview with Colonel Robert S. Peacock at his home in North Saanich, British Columbia. Today is November 20th, 2006. Well, thank you for taking the time to do this, sir. And we're just wondering maybe if you could start with a little bit of background about yourself. Where did you grow up, for instance?
Well, born in Walkerville, Ontario. Grew up in Hamilton. Went to schools, public school and high school in the west end of Hamilton. And in 1948, I went off to Canadian Service College's Weld Roads for 2 years, then to the Royal Military College for the final 2 years, and then was commissioned and into the Army. But through high school, I was just a normal high school student and played sports and got involved in absolutely everything and very, very little with studies. So other than that, a pretty normal upbringing. I've had a lot of time with cadets, air cadets, Army cadets, and up till I went into military college.
So. Perfect. And what were the things that motivated you to join the Army in the first place?
Oh, I grew up as a teenager in World War II, and World War II ended before I was of age. And during the 46 to 49, the world was going downhill pretty darn quickly. With NATO forming in 49, as I was entering military college, I had made up my mind that I was going to go into the Army at one stage or another, and this military college gave me the avenue that I wanted.
All right, and so you went straight from high school into military college?
Yep.
Was there any kind of was there a tradition in your family of military service? Did your father or grandfather serve?
Oh, my uncle served. No great tradition.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was just something you just wanted to do?
Yeah. And probably the influence of all my time in cadets. And
perfect. The time that the Canadian Army was being ready to be deployed to Korea, what was the what did the public know about Korea, and what did they think of the situation there that you know of?
When you think back to it, now I was in military college when it broke out, and we had many discussions in our history and geopolitical sessions about this and the importance of this in the Cold War. So I was well briefed on what it was we were supposed to be going to and why it was there. But the general public had no idea of what Korea was. They didn't know whether it was an apple or it was a place that you sent missionaries.
Right.
And unless you had studied history, you didn't realize that the Korean Peninsula was a focus of occupations by Russians, by Chinese, by Japanese for 900 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a battlefield. And both my wife and I agree that people at home had no idea, even when the war was going on, of what was going
on.
Right. And I'll give you a classic example. When we returned from Korea, some of my soldiers went down to join the Canadian Legion, and they were told they couldn't be members because they were only in a police action.
It wasn't a war.
It wasn't a war, and therefore they could be associate members only. And one corporal said, well, if it was a police action, it was an awful tough beat in an awful tough neighborhood, and we walked in pairs. And so I've never been with the Legion ever since. I And they changed their tune very, very quickly, but nevertheless, it left a stigma.
Absolutely. That's what was the attitude of the soldiers going across to Korea? What did they think of the situation there? Did they? I suppose, like you say, you were in staff college, so you knew.
Well, I was in military college when I graduated, right. I flew over, but so I didn't do the long boat ride.
Mm, okay.
But the average soldier, he joined for 1,001 reasons. I think mostly to get away from home, get out and have a big adventure. I didn't really perceive exactly what he was getting into. Some of them did. But on the whole, most of them are just 18, 19, 20 years of age in 3rd Battalion. In 1st Battalion, they were 22 to 24 and had been regular soldiers, so they knew what they were getting into.
Right.
So they're two different approaches. And they came from all over the country. And different attitudes. And different amounts of training. But the culture shock of the Far East was pretty heavy on a lot of them.
Oh, I bet.
And some of them tended to withdraw on themselves. Others just took full advantage of everything and just loved it. Just take your own personality and make it work.
Yeah, everybody's different, I guess. And as for your training, where prior to going to Korea, where did that take place?
Oh, in those days, we had 4 months field training a year in military college for 3 years. And in some cases, I had 4.5 or one year, 5 months, because that's where we made our money. Because in those days, it wasn't you weren't paid to go to military college. You paid, so most of us had to stay on duty in the summer because we were getting paid as second lieutenants, and therefore we would save our money all summer long to pay back to the government for our fees for the next year. So that was I had close to 14 months training, military training, before I went to Korea. Matter of fact, my third phase training was in Calgary at Currie Barracks, and I was the only officer in B Company for close to 7 weeks. All the others were away on special duties or being shipped to Europe, or and this was the company I joined in Korea a year later, so
right.
So that was really a bonus.
And what kinds of things were you trained for prior to being shipped over?
Everything. In World War II standards, we were trained to a competent level as platoon commanders of infantry platoons. And I think that's a fair estimation, except we were trained in World War II weaponry. We were trained in World War II tactics, and which you found out had very little to do with what we were going to be faced with in Korea. When we arrived in Korea, it was World War I. Trench warfare, wiring, right. Mines, patrolling, shelling, mortaring. Only they added aircraft bombing and stuff like that. It was a very fixed. It had become extremely intense.
Right.
In shelling, which was different than the 2nd Battalion, who had a lot more mobility. more like World War II for them, but ours was more like World War I with bunkers and machine gun posts and the patrolling. Patrolling was a highly skilled art there, and we were not as well trained as the enemy in that when we arrived, so we had to increase our skills very, very quickly.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
And, yeah, most people did, but some didn't and paid the price, so.
How soon after you arrived in Korea did you see combat? How much of a gap was there before you really saw some action?
10 days.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. My first action was to go up as a reconnaissance party to, as we were doing a relief in the line with the Royal Norfolk Regiment in one of the British brigades. And just as we arrived, the Chinese had misjudged. They usually like to make an attack when units are in halfway through a relief in the line, if they can time it.
Mm-hmm.
They were about a day ahead, and as a result, the Norfolks had, this was their last fight in Korea. They had quite a night of it through the Chinese back, but we just happened to get caught up in it, and that's where I saw my first casualty, which reminded me that this is not Hollywood.
Right.
Yeah. It's people get hurt and badly hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And once you learn that, you start move with a little more caution. Yeah.
Was it common for people to go into combat for the first time with I guess like you say, the Hollywood scenes in their head and it was...
Well, that's the only thing they've got to work with. I mean, Hollywood did not produce movies like Saving Private Ryan or Iron Cross and Stalingrad, those which are brutal depictions of probably much more realistic than most of the others, where people are running around with shirts and ties and all clean and neat. And I was watching one the other night, just dial twisting, and it, here they were. They'd been in action for 3 weeks, and my gosh, he didn't have a crease down his shirt.
You know,
people. People learn very quickly,
mm-hmm.
and thank goodness they learn quickly.
do you think that the training that you and the training your men received prepared you for combat adequately, or was that something that...
No. Our training was... when you look at the training records of a number of your soldiers, they joined, they did training, and then they were sent off as a draft to another unit, and of course there's an upset there, there's administration. We had soldiers arriving in Korea who'd never thrown a grenade. And we had to teach them grenades. Most of the other weapons, we had to teach them on the ground. They knew what a rifle was, of course, the bolt action Lee Enfield. But for example, in our platoon, we have 3.30 caliber machine guns and a 50 caliber machine gun. Where they all came from, I just inherited them. but you had to train your troops in all these new weapons.
Right.
We had a 3.5 inch rocket launcher, which most people had never seen before. Other weapons in the area were 75-millimeter recoilless rifles, which none of us had ever seen or used. I had been trained on 3-inch mortar, and what they used there was 81 with a whole different fire control system. We had ample brain guns. But the soldiers were not trained in knife fighting. They were not trained to the level that was necessary in patrolling. But they were good kids. My gosh, they learned quickly.
How were you equipped in the field? You mentioned some of the weapons you had, but how? I've read in some places that the Canadian Army was, it was just kind of thrown together, and you.
We were using World War II equipment, right, basically, with adaptions locally, picking up American equipment wherever we could scrounge it, and British equipment. Our dress was World War II, completely inadequate for the Korean countryside and the climate. So we scrounged British, strangely enough, we scrounged British winter gear and some American winter gear. The British winter gear was better than ours. Ours is excellent for floating around the tundra up in northern Canada, but the weather there was freezing at night and warmed up during the day, so you're always between mud and freezing.
Right.
And so if you had, you got your feet wet, your feet would freeze. When you hearken back to the trenches of 1915, the biggest problem to Canadians was the fact that they were suffering trench foot. Amazing. As one policeman said, I come from Winnipeg. And I'm a policeman in Winnipeg, and I never had frozen feet. But the weather conditions, wet, freezing, thawing, this was very damaging on all your clothing.
Right.
And so your clothing, we adjusted our clothing very, very quickly. Matter of fact, the joke was around that any time you see three Patricias together, you'd see four different orders of dress. You wore what was comfortable.
Mm-hmm. What were the day-to-day living conditions like? You mentioned some of the weather was difficult to cope with, but when you were out in the field there, how did you get by day-to-day?
Night and day from monsoon season to winter. Monsoon season was hot, humid, rainy. I mean, rain like you've never seen. One point we had tail end of a typhoon came across, and I think we had 11 or 12 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, and just flooded absolutely everything, and your trenches were just filled with water. Bunkers collapsed. And from that you got health problems. Water was a key thing, having fresh potable water. You didn't waste it. And ended up with diseases like ringworm, soldiers call it, another one crotch rot. You got fungus, nothing ever dried out.
Right.
And your weapons would rust in front of your eyes, all your equipment and clothing. clothing and become moldy and mildewed overnight. So we were always taking stuff down. You know, whenever you got a break in the weather, you'd go down to a local stream and wash it off, soak them and dry them out.
Right.
And back to business. Now, getting into winter is entirely different. Don't forget you're living in bunkers, which my book will show you a couple of them there. Dugouts, heavily sandbagged and infested with rats and other types of vermin. And in winter we had makeshift stoves out of 25-pounder ammunition boxes and mortar tubes, or the tubes that the mortar bombs came in, and dripped from a jerry can down into a pan of sand or dirt, and that kept your place warm.
Right.
And that would eat up about a couple of gallons a night for every bunker. So that all had to be humped up the hill on an A-frame, and along with your water and your rations and everything. Everything was manual. There were no vehicles came up. You couldn't get them up. So then the closest place your vehicles would come would be called a jeep head, which would be, probably in our case, on two positions. Well over a quarter of a mile away, up a hill. So soldiers had to go down in work parties and hump the stuff up. Occasionally you get Korean Service Corps laborers to porters to come and carry stuff up, especially when we had a big wiring party. We would have a platoon of Korean Service Corps. They would carry the stakes and the wire up.
Right.
And, because, you know, Each roll of wire is about 60 pounds.
Oh, wow.
A bunch of stakes is probably about 70 pounds. And so if you were doing 100 yards of wiring, you would probably need maybe 10 or 15 rolls of wire and maybe 10 or 15 bundles of stakes. So, you know, that was in winter, the ground was frozen, but you still had to continue digging the trenches, so we used explosives, picks, and winter is very, very cold. Cold like, the wind off the Siberian steppes coming down and through the mountain passes. It's the coldest I've ever been. And freeze your ears in seconds. One night we started out at 9 o'clock at night, and it was about 40 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And the next morning it was zero with a high wind. And just temperature change over, as you would look at it, the temperature would change. And in summer, you'd be looking at a bright, sunny sky, and then all of a sudden, bang, you were in a downpour.
Right, just like that?
And just absolutely soaked. Because once you're soaked, there's nothing you can do. You're just soaked right through.
Right.
Now, life there, eating, most places we got hard rations or compo rations, mostly British with an American supplement, and whatever you could scrounge. And we liked that. We would get one hot meal a day brought up by porters.
Okay.
And usually breakfast. And that would be fed. The men would come down in relays and get fed after stand two in the morning. So you just bring them down in relays, leaving half of your people on stand two. And most of the rest of the time, you use compo rations, and people could sleep and get up and make their own whatever they wanted to eat. So they would nibble because people were off doing other duties.
Right.
There was always food when they came back, and then they would sleep when they could and eat when they could. And on the whole, I felt we lived from a point of view of food. We did very well in 1st and 3rd Battalions. I know it was pretty short in 2nd Battalion on a few occasions, but things like New Zealand transport people flogging fresh bread, butter, and cheese for exchange for some of our American PX rations, which would be candy, shaving soap, some old cigarettes, chocolate bars, that sort of stuff.
Right.
And we would get that. And occasionally, I had an American forward air controller who stayed with me for a few days, and he managed to get me up a tin of peanut butter. Not just a tin, a gallon tin.
Oh, right.
And I love peanut butter. And that was, so, you know, enterprising soldiers or enterprising units never went without.
Mm-hmm.
And when you looked at things, there was, for example, a divisional ice cream making machine. And it was an American one, and naturally, I've never found any on our establishment. But strangely enough, on a couple of occasions during the summer month, we got a dollop of ice cream when we were out of the line, which we just said, you know, this is war. Food was good. We had lots of chicken, lots of steaks, beef. Some of the hard rations the troops didn't like, but there are a number of them. All you needed to do was add some curry powder and see if you could scrounge some onions someplace.
Oh.
And the British had a lamb stew, which a bit of curry powder, boy, came up pretty well.
What was the morale like day to day among the men in the field?
On the whole, Canadian soldier is a remarkably happy guy, as long as he's treated with respect and not browbeaten. Just give him his job and let him go and do it. They're generally speaking, hardworking. Most of my platoons were from the Maritimes. You know, a good portion of them were Newfoundland or Cape Breton. A measure of how they regarded the thing was, hey, this is the first pair of boots I've had. I get fed and I get clothed and I got a good pair of boots and they pay me. And, okay, boss. And we were always boss, not sir, boss. Because that's how they treated their foreman when they were working.
Right.
So, you know, they just transposed that. So that was something that you just had to adapt to. Some people didn't, but it wasn't a matter of disrespect they were showing. It was just they were showing this was the line of authority.
Right.
You are the boss. And so, you know, I think their morale was, every once in a while, one of them would get down, especially after an action. you could see, you know, what in the hell have I gotten myself into? Sort of approach. But on the whole, the other guys would rally around him. You didn't have to go down and do any personnel counseling. It was all done in the sections. I can't. Well, I can think of a couple who got very morose. Well, what you do is you send them off to work at company headquarters for a couple of days.
Oh, yeah.
And give them a change, and pretty soon they want to come back to their platoon. So, you know, you just keep rotating people out for little jobs, and
right, just, you know, break it up a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
What were some of the things that affected morale, other than, what were some of the things that, I know I read about, how there were daily rum rations, and, you know, troops would get a bottle of beer a day in some cases.
Well, you paid for that. It wasn't on a ration. It came up and paid 25 cents.
But you paid for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this came up. This was on, but they call the NAFI, what they call it? Armed Forces Institute. The Navy, Army, Air Force Institute, British, / Empire Forces Institute, Far East. And the beer would come up, boy, don't you ever break any. You know, who's going down on the beer run? There are lots of people going down to haul the beer back up. Go down and haul up wire? Not me. Go down and haul up water. But the beer, yes. No, that was a good morale breaker or morale booster. The service rum demerara or seldom reaches destination or whatever other thing you wish to use with it. Was given in an inclement weather, which we had a lot, and the job of the sergeant major was to go around with his stone crock and pour out the stuff. You drank it there.
Oh, yeah.
This wasn't to be saved for a rainy day. You either put it in your coffee or you drank it straight. And a lot of soldiers never took it. They didn't like it. So great stock of it would get built up. Matter of fact, at one place, I had a few gallon jugs of it and just said to the platoon, when you come in off stand two, there it is. Just don't abuse it. And it was never abused. They would come in and have a pot, put it in their coffee, we'd have a little conversation of their time on stand two, and on a very cold night I would pack up a canteen of SRD and go around on stand two and give everyone a thing, because it's nothing better than a good jolt like that to keep you awake. Food was always there. There was never a shortage. Even when the rations didn't come up regularly, we always had hard rations in the platoon, so you could live for 2 or 3 days on. You couldn't eat all your hard rations. And if you left them around, unfortunately, the rats would come.
Right.
So that the rats were probably the most depressing part of the whole thing. And also, whenever there was shelling in a place, and trenches would break open, or you'd find the remnants of previous battles coming to the surface, and you had to rebury and pieces and stuff like that. And so we had a pit out. I think every platoon had a trench at the rear where they would take these little bits and pieces and go and bury them.
How did the troops cope with the loss of their fellow soldiers in battle? Were there a lot of casualties in your units?
Well, we had we were very, very fortunate. We didn't have too many, and most of them were not fatalities. They were just wounds. And in many cases, a fellow would get wounded, and they would laugh at him and say, "You lucky guy, you got a Japanner," which meant that you were wounded enough to get through the evacuation system and spend a month or so in Japan. And a homer was you were very badly wounded and you would be air-evac back to Canada. And a Poussaner was you got yourself killed. That's where the graveyard was. Soldiers cope remarkably well because the evacuation system was so fast. The person was there, and then they were gone. So there wasn't the hangover of people around the company being badly wounded or corpses or anything like that. That was just, they were just moved out so quickly down the evacuation chain that the only thing you're thinking about was, how is he doing if he's wounded? He's okay, he's out of here. And if he was killed, well, that's tough luck. And get on with the job. Now, some brooded over some of this with good friends, but on the whole, they coped very well.
Did you have much experience dealing with any of the local Korean civilian population?
Not too much with the local Korean population, because behind the line, they had a line where there was no civilians.
Oh, okay.
It's about a good 10 miles back. Now, there were Korean laborers attached to the unit, and we had indigenous Korean labor in the Korean Service Corps. So I got to know a number of them, and strange enough, we had each platoon had a Korean houseboy to do laundry, stuff like that. And he was usually about, who knows, 15, 16, 14, who knows. So you got to know a few of these kids. So I had no real contact with them until I got out to the junior NCO school in the spring of 53. And of course, you're right into the midst of Korean farms and Korean communities and everything else, and a whole different picture. And you were learning a whole new culture shock.
Right.
Yeah. In the time of the line, very little contact with Korean civilians. After that, yes, you'd run into them. The ones I met were very, very poor, eking out an existence. All women, small children, and old men. Because all men of eligible age were in the army. And I mean men from 15, 16
right.
to 50.
Right, all of them.
Everybody was gone. So you'd find the old men and a few able-bodied people doing all of the farm work. Very, very laborious farm work. And of course all the women were out planting rice, harvesting rice, sorghum, millet, and believe it or not, in all this, they were always clean.
Hmm.
Clothes were clean. Kids were well taken care of. Kids were loved. I had a few good days going through Korean villages, talking with the elders, and taking pictures. If you're interested, you can go over and I'll put some of them on for you. They're a tough people. Mm. Korean is a tough. He's a survivor.
Yeah, I guess they had to be with him.
Oh yeah, and
the war they've seen.
And they're a tough opponent.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Were the enemy that you were facing was it mainly Chinese or were they
also North Koreans? Yeah, we had mainly Chinese. Matter of fact, there's only one evidence of any North Koreans opposite us. It was all Chinese, root armies, and they were well trained, well equipped, well dressed. And well fed.
What was the impression that Canadian soldiers had of the enemy, the Chinese? How did they see them?
Well, they respected them. I think a number of them came over with the idea that they were facing a bunch of laundrymen. They were quickly disabused of that, and they found that the Chinese skills on patrols and their skills at field craft and weaponry were a very high standard,
right.
And we just better smarten up.
Did you have much experience working with troops from other countries? Americans, British, South Koreans?
This was, you had to do liaison on two occasions. I was on the left-hand side of the western side of the division. We were right up against the U.S. Marine 7th Regiment, and we did a lot of liaison back and forward there, as our trenches joined. And on the right-hand side of the division, or the northeast corner, we were the right-hand company, and just across the, I guess about 100 yards away, the American 3rd Division started. So we shared routes and roads and things of this nature. And, of course, the different systems. You did a lot of liaison between yourselves just to make sure that fire plans were coordinated, and you knew where their patrols were and where their outposts were and what their signals were. And they, likewise, wanted to find out where you were, what you were doing. So there's a fair amount of briefing going on. I was back in brigade as a liaison officer for 3 months when the division was out of the line, and so I got an awful lot more exposure to Korean divisions and other American divisions and rear area, and that Commonwealth Division headquarters, which was a mixture of Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans, Canadians, British.
Oh, right.
So you were always mixing, and everyone got along pretty well. You know, a few dust-ups once in a while, but
right.
You get that in your own country.
Mm-hmm.
On the whole, it, strange enough, it worked quite well.
Was that, were there any major differences that you noticed between the Canadians and, say, the American soldiers or the, you know, the Australians, British, anyone else?
Well, British were mostly in national service, so there was, in many units, there was a certain passivity to their actions. But units like the Black Watch or the Northumberland Fusiliers or the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, and some of those were first-class units under any circumstances. American Marines I had a high respect for. Other units like the 65th Puerto Rican Regiment, I had no confidence when they were on our flank.
Right.
15th Regiment of the same division, I had a lot more confidence. So,
right.
You know, it's a question of leadership and how they've been trained. Well, I think an American Marine general put it as clearly as anyone I've ever heard. He said, he's the luckiest general in the world. He has the Yellow Sea on his left-hand side, and he has the Commonwealth Division on his right. All I have to do is worry about my front. And I think that was, that's the type of confidence you wanted. Now, Australians, very good, very well-trained, unbelievably cocky, but we used to admire their submachine gun called the Owen gun. We would try and steal one any time we could, but they guarded those pretty closely.
Yeah. What was the relationship in general between, you know, the officers and the enlisted ranks within the Canadian forces in Korea? How did they see each other?
Oh, you could, that varies unit to unit and officer to officer and man to man. It depends on the relationship that you develop. I had the great fortune to join a company where I was known because I had been with them in training a year earlier. So I was a known quantity coming into the unit, and some of them were known to me. Not all, but all the senior NCOs I was known, and they knew me. So when I went there, they said, what company you want to go to? And I said, well, I get back to B company. And they said, oh, well, you're going there. I'm talking to the other three reinforcements. Which company do you want to go to? Now, I'd already been, the company had said, here's four of them coming, we want him.
Right.
Which was, that's good to be, to be a usable commodity, I guess. Now, the relationship between officers and men, this is a difficult one. I never became buddy-buddy with soldiers.
Right.
Be approachable. Be there. Do your job. take care of them, and I don't mean coddle them, I just mean take care of their interests. But the officers who decided to go on a first-name basis, get very, very casual, always had problems. Because sometime you have to make hard decisions.
Right.
And you can't be buddy-buddy one day and then turn it on and be the hard platoon commander the next. You have to be consistent. So fair, firm, and friendly, I think, is the series of words that was drummed into us. And also, when you look at a number of our platoon commanders, and I'm talking just the platoon commanders now, a number of them had just been promoted from sergeants or corporals. So some of them hadn't made the transition. Many had. And the toughest ones in the troops were usually the ones who were trying to be more officer than the others, because they were now going to exert their authority. And many of those were first class platoon commanders. But they were much tougher on their troops than many of the rest of us. So it's, you know, what's our relationship? Pick your company, pick your relationship, and you've got the whole world to choose from. And just so many different ones. Now, the relationships from battalion down to companies and down to platoons, we found it was reasonably remote. Very seldom saw your battalion commander. Company commanders, company commanders varied so differently because of their personalities or their experiences. Some of them extremely good, and others completely mediocre and out of place. They shouldn't have been commanding a company. They were getting, I would think, they were over there getting their ticket punched as a company commander. But we had some excellent company commanders. We had some duds.
Hmm.
A few of them were a little too heavy in the sauce. On the whole, there's a lot of experience there, and you learn as much from the bad as you do from the good.
Okay.
So what's your relationship? Again, take your pick. I write that in my book that I knew very little about my commanding officer in 3rd Battalion. I knew very, very little about him. I had met him when 3rd Battalion arrived, and I didn't see him again until each patrol action. I went down to battalion headquarters to get briefed on a couple of occasions, and I wasn't briefed by the battalion commander, I was briefed by the operations officer. And I never did see him. And I didn't see him until he came up with the brigadier one day. And I record that my soldiers had never seen him either. And so who was he? So that sticks in your head, boy. You better be around and be known.
Right.
Yeah. Company commanders. In 3rd Battalion, my company commander came around every day. In 1st Battalion, very, very seldom. And left on your own. And this is something, the way the battalions were laid out, the companies were laid out, you were quite isolated from each other even. we were spread out all over the place, and very little, with such an effort to get from one area to another.
Right.
That you were literally running your own private war. Yeah. For many weeks at a time. And well, that's so what's the relationships? What are your relationships in university?
Right, I guess it completely depends.
Yeah, it depends on who you're talking to and how you fit in.
Were there, did you notice any major differences between the soldiers who might have volunteered to go to Korea as part of the Special Force versus those who were part of the regular army to start with?
Yeah, the Special Force, when they first came in, they pretty wild looking bunch when I saw them coming in Calgary in 1950. But this was not the Special Force that Colonel Stone ended up with in Korea. He had gone through hundreds and hundreds of people and sent them off to for discharge or get rid of them.
Right.
They just didn't match up. And by the time he got his 2nd Battalion to Korea, they were a darn good unit. And they were well officered. They were better officered. The first 3 battalions that went into the Special Service Force were the best officered battalions that ever went over, in my estimation.
Hmm.
Because the battalion commanders selected their company commanders and they selected the officers. Whereas afterwards, they just came in from the personnel system, so you didn't know what you were getting.
Right.
So General Dextraz, or Colonel Stone, Colonel Dextraz, Colonel Campbell, and General Rockingham picked their staff and they picked their people. And that is a lesson to be learned, is that the selection of your leaders is a quintessential part of having good organization.
Right.
After that, units were formed, drafts would come in, you'd get a whole bunch of names to fill in, and you didn't know the quality. There was no relationship. No one had gone through a screening test to say, this guy's going to be okay, this guy's not going to be okay. You had to learn that once they got there and in the field.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, which is a hard way to learn. But then again, I didn't, the so-called regular force wasn't. This is a bit of mythology which is perpetuated by people in the Directorate of Military History, that the 1st Battalions were all regular force. The fact of the matter is that those regular battalions were broken up, and willy-nilly sent to form 27th Brigade, officered and NCOs to go to units in the 27th Brigade in Europe. They sent officers and NCOs to staff out the 2nd Battalions that went to Korea. And then they sent people, and the army was expanding 4 times inside of about 14 months.
Hmm.
So they had to get people. As I said, I was in a rifle company, supposedly in an airborne regiment or battalion, and out of that 4 companies, you couldn't put an airborne company together.
Hmm.
Because all these were new people coming in. All the old NCOs had gone off for commissioning.
Right.
As a result, drafts would be coming in from 3rd Battalion to 1st Battalion, and then drafts would go from 1st Battalion to 2nd Battalion, and so there was just a constant thing. I was the only officer for 6 weeks in B Company as an officer cadet.
Hmm.
And I couldn't, disciplinary trials, I used to march people down to one company commander who was still there.
Hmm.
And so he had the right of summary trial, and so I would march my my culprits down there. But you know, the regular battalions, you know, that's just sheer mythology. And when they did get there, there was still a hard core of first class NCOs, and the framework of the unit was still there, and they trained very well. But they didn't go over as a cohesive unit. They were still being fed in with drafts of people from 3rd Battalion.
Right.
And, of course, 3rd Battalion had the same problem. They just get the unit up and trained, and a whole draft would go away, and they have to start retraining again. So when they arrived in Crib, they picked up a mishmash of us from 1st Battalion, and then a whole bunch of people they hadn't even seen before would come in. So,
people moving every which way all the time.
Oh, just and this myth is perpetuated in, I notice it in Bill Johnson's book War Patrols. He seizes on the fact that and Herbie Wood, who wrote the Canadian Army in Korea, Strange Battleground, talks about the regular force. Well, there was an aura of that, of 1st Battalion stuff. But when you look beneath the surface, the background to that isn't there.
Right, it's one of those things, I guess, you know, maybe it was that way on paper, but then, once you see
that,
it's...
That was supposed to be, that was the image, but the image did not fit with reality.
No.
Now, I was in the middle of it, and I felt I was observing a mix of people going all over the place, people out to Europe, here to here, so and so. And when first battalion was born for Korea, the next day 200 people came in from 3rd Battalion.
Hmm.
So if it was a full, regular, first-class battalion, why did they need 200 people?
Right.
So you start asking a lot more questions than that, because not only did they need 200, they needed another 150 a little later.
Right.
So
how complete was it to start with?
Yeah.
At the end of the war, at the end of your tour in Korea, when you came back to Canada, what kind of reception did you get? Was it was there any kind of fanfare? Was it just you showed up and it's like, oh, where were you?
talk about a known event. Arrived in after a very hectic tour by Canadian Pacific Airways, arrived in Vancouver at 3:30 in the morning. There's a movement control NCO there who was rather impatient that he had to get out of bed to meet this draft of people coming back, and the troops with us. Shuffled into Jericho Beach Barracks, and we sort of try to get our paybooks in order and get on the train as quickly as possible. And no fanfare, no band, no nothing, not even a thank you. Very interesting, the reaction to this. Many soldiers went home expecting some sort of a recognition, and did not receive any. Matter of fact, Most of them said they couldn't even turn off the television long enough to say hello. You know, the television was new, and something else was going on.
Right.
It might be baseball or something. So, yeah. Did you have a good trip? Yeah. Okay. Have a good time.
Nice to have
Nice meeting you. Thank you very much. Was the Korean War been written about as, you know, a forgotten war? And like you say, you know, there was that that lack of a reaction with the soldiers coming home and whatnot. But what's your take on the whole idea of Korea not even being recognized as a war? Why do you think it's been, you know, as forgotten in, you know, Canadian history as it is?
It was an embarrassment for the government, in my humble opinion. And don't forget, Canada is, its interests at that time are centered on Europe.
Right.
And NATO was coming, and we were putting an air division into Europe, we were putting a brigade group into Europe, and Korea, in spite of the fact it was a full-scale war, got the leftovers. the government, once again, was unprepared for an emergency, a military emergency,
right,
or a political emergency, and so they chose their priority, and it was Europe.
So basically, Korea was just overshadowed by events in Europe. Is that?
Oh yeah, yeah. This was a dangerous period. Don't forget, 1953. There were riots in East Germany. This was just after NATO was formed, and we're barely getting our troops into Germany. The Russians outnumber 10-1 in the Eastern Bloc to the Western Bloc, and it was, the only thing that stopped the Russians taking advantage of our weakness was a nuclear weapon.
Right.
Because I'll give you an example. When I first went to Germany in 1955, the defensive deployment was based on the Rhine. A year later, it was up on the Weser River, farther toward the east. And when I went back in 63, we were right up on the East German border. So that was where our contact, we had defensive lines all the way. But because the Germans had now started to rebuild, and they're not going to just defend on the Rhine, they want to defend all of Germany.
Right.
Therefore, everyone moved forward. But the only defensible line in 1953 was the Rhine River. And of course, that would only protect the Benelux countries, France,
right.
And Germany was just be another battlefield. Once the Germans started getting back into this business, that was unacceptable. So we went. So that's always been the focus of Canada. It's only been in the last few years that Canada has become Asia-minded because of the rise of China, rise of India, rise of the industrial commercial aspects of Japan,
right,
and Korea and Taiwan, Singapore. Goodness gracious, here we have all these markets and we're still focusing on Europe, who treats us like dirt.
Yeah.
You deal with the French. I'm showing a bit of a bias here. Anytime you deal with a European country, you can rest assured their national interest comes first before international.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are, naive Canadians. International interests goodwill or good works take precedence over national interest.
Yeah.
Isn't that a...
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That's a truism. China is just showing that right now. Chinese national interests are paramount.
Yeah, you know.
So, you know, we have a lot to learn, a lot to adapt to.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get a little more pragmatic.
Yeah. How do you think that the how did the veterans of Korea deal with being, you know, kind of, you know, shuffled aside and forgotten about in the way that they seem to have been?
It irritates some people. Most of us consider it just another political joke,
right,
the way they treat it. As the Korean Volunteer Service Medal was mailed out to us. Now, you could have, in all fairness, you could have had someone present it to you. But there was no formal public presentation. You know, what these medals were presented to in small legion gatherings or not out of the public eye almost.
Right.
Except to interested people. So it was a bit of a, I've always considered it sort of an ironic joke. Well, just an example, the 2nd Battalion received a presidential unit citation, and they couldn't wear the citation badge for about 6 years.
Hmm.
Because Ottawa said, well, that's a foreign decoration, we can't put that up. And the British had it up, and the French had them up, and other people had them up.
The Canadians who won it couldn't wear it.
Yeah, and even now, the South Korean government had a medal. This does bother some of our people. They had a medal that they wanted to give to all United Nations troops as service in Korea. And the Americans have it, and I think the British have it. Canada said no. Thank you very much.
Hmm. How long ago was this?
Oh, this is years and years ago. But it still rankles with some of the vets.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. My attitude is, if you get another medal, you have to get them remounted, and that's another $150.
Best not to bother, Dave. Well, thank you very much. That's all the actual questions that I have for you formally. Is there anything else you wanted to add or that you think is important to mention?
The one thing I think people should recognize is that soldiers do not change. I do a lot of research on World War I opening stages and other parts of military history, and my finding is that we have a wealth of excellent soldiers or excellent potential soldiers, and the one thing, if they're well led and well trained, they're the best in the world. But we also have a government which has every priority in the world ahead of national defense. And we pay the price every generation. So, off my soapbox.
Thank you very much.